Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep them rolling. Production Board, in cooperation with WOR and Mutual, presents the 22nd in this weekly series of programs of entertainment and information about America's united war effort. Your master of ceremonies is one of the most distinguished figures of the contemporary theater, the well-known author and playwright, George S. Kaufman.
Tonight, April 5th, Easter Sunday. Tomorrow, April 6th, Army Day. Cynics will smirk at that and say, what a commentary on civilization, when the day of the Prince of Peace is followed immediately by the day of our men of war. But there's no inconsistency here. He was the Prince of Peace. Tomorrow's marching troops are the price of peace. For by their sacrifices and their victory shall the world be saved. The Prince and the marching troops are one in spirit. It's fitting that we should dedicate our program tonight, then, to one of the great branches of the Army whose day we honor tomorrow, the United States Army Air Corps. Present to take part in that dedication are such celebrated exponents of the free spirit as
one of Hollywood's loveliest and most talented dramatic stars, Merle Oberon. The gifted and personable young star of screen and radio, Tyrone Power. The distinguished baritone of the Metropolitan Opera, John Charles Thomas. And the versatile composer-conductor, Morton Gould.
And now John Charles Thomas opens our program by capturing the sweep and power of America's wings as he sings the Army Air Corps song, Mr. Thomas. The official song of the Army Air Force, of the men who are flying our planes against the Axis. And now with us tonight are two of the flying officers who are responsible for the success of these men and the efficiency of the planes that they fly. Colonel Roy M. Jones, Army Supervisor of the Aircraft Production in the Eastern District, and Major General Follett Bradley, the distinguished commander of the 1st Air Forces, who is in charge of the defense of our Eastern Seaboard.
That was a very complimentary introduction, Mr. Kaufman, but I wish you hadn't placed the emphasis on defense.
I'm sorry, General, but you are in charge of the Air Forces of the Eastern Defense Command.
That is true, Mr. Kaufman, I am. But that is not our most important job.
You don't mean to say that defending New York, Boston, Miami, all of those cities from air attacks is not important?
No, of course not. It is important. But it is not as important as carrying this war to the Nazis and Japs on every strategic battlefront of the world. From now on, this is going to be an offensive war.
Good. But suppose that Hitler's bombers attack our cities, or don't you think there is any possibility of that, General?
But on the contrary, Mr. Kaufman, I think there is every possibility that the enemy may bomb New York, Boston, and other key cities.
And is our Air Force going to let them get away with it? What about all those planes that we're producing, those pilots that we're training?
They are needed on every strategic battlefront on which the Axis is fighting. The people of this country have been calling for an offensive against the enemy, and we are going to give it to them.
Well, does that mean that if a squadron of enemy bombers should come over this city tonight, that they could get through and reach their objective?
Unfortunately, they might. In that case, it is going to be up to our civilian population to take it, and not holler for planes and men to be taken away from our offensive action against the Axis. That's what Hitler would like to have us do. That's one of the reasons we may get some token bombings.
Was there anything at all that the civilian population can do to help in defense against these attacks?
Yes. They can cooperate with the Army Air Forces by straining every effort to get out more and better planes. Obviously, the more planes we have, the stronger our defense, as well as our offense, will be.
Well, just how is our plane production coming along? Are we going to get that capacity of 60,000 planes this year?
That's a question that I think can best be answered by Colonel Jones, who is supervisor of aircraft production for the Eastern District.
That's an easy question to answer, Mr. Kaufman. We're going to get to 60,000 plane capacity this year, but it's not going to be an easy goal to achieve. It's going to mean plenty of sweat and sacrifice on the part of everyone, and even with that, there are problems.
Could you be a little more specific about those problems, Colonel?
Yes, our biggest problem is that of shortages. Shortage of material and shortage of skilled labor.
And how is the Army Air Force meeting those shortages?
In the main, that's a responsibility of industry and not the Army Air Force. But the Army Air Force is cooperating with industry to lick both of these problems. And with labor, management, and the armed forces cooperating, there's no question but that we are going to lick them. The material shortages, for instance, we are meeting that by priorities, by conserving and diverting materials from civilian use to war needs. That means sacrifice, but it's nothing compared to the sacrifice we are all going to have to make if we lose this war.
Well, I think that people are cheerfully going to help meet the shortages of material by making whatever sacrifices are necessary. But how can we help with the shortage of skilled labor?
That's a job for men over 45 and women.
Tell me, how does the work of women compare with that of men in war?
Very favorably. Not only are our women workers doing as good a job as our men, but in some instances, they do a better job. There are various operations in the manufacture of airplanes and airplane instruments that are delicate and require the careful hands of women.
Well, that's at least an encouraging note, Colonel. From what you say, it looks as though we're going to be able to meet both shortages without disrupting production. While we're on the subject of shortages, what about the highly trained pilots that we need to fly those planes?
That's one for General Bradley. How about that, General?
Our pilot training program is keeping pace with our program of aircraft production. But even so, we need more men. We are training hard, day and night. Remember, we are just getting started. We are just learning mass training. We are now getting for the first time the opportunity for which a few of us have been battling for 25 years. The opportunity of creating the most powerful, striking force the world has ever known, and we promise you we are making the most of it.
And we assure in turn that that promise will be kept. Thank you, General Bradley, and thank you, Colonel Jones. Even modern war is not so wholly mechanized a thing as to be separate entirely from the warmth of human sentiment. In fact, the alarms of war quicken our feelings and our human awareness of each other. Morton Gould now demonstrates this common phenomenon in music as he leads the orchestra in his own arrangement of Drums in My Heart. There have been dark times in this fight for freedom, times when men and women have stood among their ruined homes and have said, why are we defenseless? Where were our own men, our own ships, our own planes? And some of them lost faith, faith the strongest weapon of all. Our play tonight tells the story of one woman who lost her faith amid the thunder of bombs under an unguarded sky and what happened to her. The play, Anthem in the Sky, was written especially for this program by Milton Geiger, directed by Arthur Curlan. And here to enact the leading roles are two of Hollywood's brightest and most talented stars, Tyrone Power and Merle Oberon. Anthem in the Sky.
Ahead of the Easter dawn, the bombers came, angry because the fog had kept their bombs from Plymouth. 12 minutes from Plymouth to the Cornish coast. The Nazi pilots must have thought, let us loose our bombs wherever we can see, rather than take them back to Germany. Out of the sudden sky, the fury came, and many in my village did not rise that day. And he who had risen must have wept and bled again. I found myself upon the slope that led up from the village to the cliffs that overlooked the sea. Weeping and helpless, I stumbled up the hill, passing the others who stood stunned and silent, looking with empty faces at what had been their homes. There was no sound after the roaring of the planes, only the hissing of the rain upon the grass, and a child whimpering in the morning gloom. In my heart, a voice cried, "Coward!" Still I fled that terror in the valley. None had gone to meet the German planes but one, and he had been shot down and none had seen where he had fallen. That was our defense against the Nazi squadrons. Why should I not flee from our own defenselessness? At last I stood upon the summit. The sea beat on the rocks below and the constant wind of the cliffs drove against my body. And I stood staring at the man I saw sitting on the wet ground.
Hello.
This is a pretty wicked mess to be in, isn't it?
You're the pilot who went up to meet the Germans.
I marched right up and marched right down again. There's my plane. I just managed to bring her down without going completely into small pieces myself.
You're hurt.
Oh, yes, it isn't bad.
Your hand is bleeding.
Well, yes.
I'll tie it up for you.
Why, I don't know.
Could you look over there for a minute, out to sea or something?
What's to be seen out there?
Well, I've got to tear my petticoat.
Oh, well, now, I don't want you to do that. Please.
Look away.
Oh, very well.
All right.
You see, I had this hand on the throttle as I came down, gripping the thing like mad, you see, and...
Let me look at it.
It really isn't very bad.
Yes, it is.
All right.
Hold out your hand so that the rain washes it more. Then we'll go down into the village. No. We can't do anything there.
Was it very bad?
It was dreadful. Dreadful and vile. They had nothing to gain by bombing us. Nothing.
No. Has the rain washed my hand enough, do you think?
Yes. Hold it still.
You're very kind.
No.
What did the people think? What did they say when they saw me in the sky?
What could they say? One plane against dozens?
Not very good odds, I suppose.
Not very good.
I know. Still, isn't even a single plane something? Isn't it some token, a promise that they haven't been forsaken, that they're not forgotten?
I only know that people I knew and loved have been murdered in their homes. And how could we prevent it? There. Did that feel better?
Much better. Do you want to try the other now?
Is the other hand hurt, too?
Yes, I pushed it through the hatch slide, trying to ram it open. No good, though. I had to come down with my ship.
Well, you're lucky the plane didn't burn.
If it might start yet, the engine's still hot.
Hold out your hand.
Like this?
That's it.
What we ought to do is get me patched up and propped up on my feet, and we'll go down and see how we can help in the village.
There's nothing we can do.
Oh, I don't know. We can help. I fancy I can help a lot myself.
I say there's nothing. No supplies, nothing. Everything has been bombed and burned and soaked with rain and mud.
Then we can be there. The sight of able, cheerful people may give the wounded hope.
They'd only resent our well-being.
I think I disagree with you.
Then you can go down there alone. I won't go with you. I've seen enough. You don't know.
I think I do. I've seen a few things myself.
It was ghastly.
But you'll go back, won't you? Of course.
No. Why should it mean so much to you? Do you have someone in the village?
Yes. Yes, I have.
But you're not English.
Not exactly.
You haven't anyone. They're perfect strangers to you.
I don't consider them either strangers or perfect. They're very imperfect human beings. If there must be some mutual bond for sympathy, then our common imperfection can be that bond. How's my hand?
It'll do for now. You need a doctor.
Good. Then we're ready to go.
Where?
To the village, to your people.
No.
But I'm ready.
I'm not.
I should think it's been bitter enough for everyone without more bitterness up here. I don't know.
I tell you, there's nothing we can do.
We can be present with our sympathy.
Sympathy? What good is a full heart with empty hands? Oh, I know about you Americans with your blind, reasonless optimism. But I saw what happened in the village when the bombers came over. I saw the sexton fall with shrapnel in his throat. I saw him drag himself into the broken church to die. I saw children blown to bits and families buried in the ruins. And why? We were defenseless. One plane rose to fight for us.
Are you angry with them for being defenseless?
No, but I've had enough. I saw all I could stand. I did everything I could until my very soul turned within me and I was sick. I can't go back to that. I can't.
All right. All right. I won't argue. You'd call me a blind optimist if I went on about hope, the future, and immortality.
Hope, the future, immortality, words. What are they against despair, the present, the wickedness and death? No, I can't go back. I should die with the horror and the pity of it if I did go back.
You don't believe in mankind very much.
How can I or anyone when we've come to this?
Life without death would lose its meaning. Hope couldn't exist without despair. I took a single plane against the enemy.
Oh, it is very gallant of you. So little. So useless.
No. No, not if it brought one pulse of hope and joy to those people in the village. Not if it said to them that they haven't been forgotten.
But how can
All right, call me a queer one, but I believe in man and his humanity, his basic goodness, even his divinity.
Yes, and we've come to this. Where is our civilization? Where is our Christianity? The creed of love and the brotherhood of man? Give me something that I can believe in. The whole world asks for that. Show us that we may believe. Lead us that we may follow. Give us a sign that we may take heart. What can I believe when the bombers hail the resurrection with death and horror? What kind of trumpet are the bombers in the sky? Where can one find faith? Give us a sign. I'm sorry. Did I blaspheme?
No. Will you help me up?
Take my hand.
Like this?
Yes.
Thanks.
Where are you going?
Down there. Perhaps I can be of help.
But you're hurt yourself.
I thought you might help me down.
I...
It's just possible you might regain your faith where you lost it. That's logical, isn't it? You asked for belief, for faith. Were you sincere?
Here. Lean on my shoulder.
Good girl.
Come, be careful. You've lost a lot of blood. Carefully. Carefully. Listen.
Yes. Bombers above the fog.
The bombers are returning. And what are those people on the slope to do? Shall we go down now and tell them to take hope? The bombers are returning. Shall we tell them that this is their reward for faith and suffering? You go and tell them. I'll stay here.
The bombers are coming from the north, looking for a clear place to turn in over the land.
A good place to drop their bombs, yes. Oh, a noble sign to fortify our souls.
There. They're coming out of the fog. We can see them now. Bombers. From America.
America?
Is that sign enough for you?
It was true. The squadron thundered down the Cornish coast, skirting the cliffs, and on their wings, the bright emblem of Britain. I looked down at the people on the slope. I saw their upturned faces in the dawn and saw the light come into them. And out of the valley of ruin came the voice of faith. And all those people on the hillside rose and went down into the village. They brought their grief into the church, but hope went with them too. And I listened to the thunder of the bombs. It was a sign, an anthem, calling to the nations to arise, calling to all mankind to be free and faithful. A sermon, a battle hymn, an anthem in the sky. I did not look back at the man. The plane was burning when I left. And I left it there to burn and went down alone to the village. I came back afterwards. The man had gone. There was nothing. Only the blackened plain. But something glistened in the ruins. I picked it up. It was a spike of crude and ancient make. There were two more of them. And I remembered that his hands had bled too. And that his plane and all those others from America had been like crosses in the sky.
John Charles Thomas pays tribute to the man of Illinois, of Gettysburg, of Washington. Mr. Thomas will introduce a new song written by Benny Davis and Peter DeRose, Abraham Lincoln from the White House in the Sky.
Called you honest Abe, they loved your wrinkled brow. You gave your counsel then, we seek your counsel now. Abraham Lincoln, sitting in the White House. Your inspiration spreads the light upon the land we love. Through the darkest days in history, your voice played a part. Though it's long ago, your memory lives in every heart. battle cry. Lead us, glory, from the White House in the sky. Up above, your inspiration spreads the light upon the land we love. Once you spoke to us from Gettysburg, the memory never wanes. Speak to all the mills and factories, make them rush full speed. Abraham Lincoln, you're the spirit of our battle cry. Lead us to glory from the White House in the sky.
Next week at this same time, we will be back with another All-Star Half Hour dedicated to what we in these United States are fighting for and why. Until then, this is George S. Kaufman reminding you to remember Pearl Harbor, and now, more than ever before, to keep 'em rolling.
This entire program was produced and directed by Arthur Curlan of the radio section of the War Production Board. Continuity was written by Mr. Curlan and Milton Geiger. The War Production Board wishes to thank Station WOR and Mutual for furnishing the time and facilities to make this evening's broadcast possible. And George S. Kaufman, Morton Gould, John Charles Thomas, Merrill Oberon, Tyrone Power, Major General Paulette Bradley, and Colonel Roy M. Jones for contributing their services tonight. We also wish to thank the Hollywood Victory Committee for the appearances of Miss Oberon and Mr. Power, as well as 20th Century Fox and the DuPont Company for Mr. Power's appearance. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.